Good afternoon. It's Friday, August 20th, 2021, and time to read from today's Sioux City Journal. I'm Sandy Barron. I'm a volunteer and pleased to be able to bring you the news today. Here's a look at what we'll be reading. First, we'll read stories of local interest. Next, we'll turn to the opinion page, and at half past the hour, we'll read the obituaries. We'll conclude with sports and feature stories as time allows. First, let's take a look at the weather. Today, a few thunderstorms, some severe, windy with winds out of the south-southeast at 12 to 25 miles per hour and a high of 86. Tonight, a severe thunderstorm early. It will be cooler. Winds out of the west-southwest at 7 to 14 miles per hour and a low of 59. Saturday will be breezy in the morning, mostly sunny with a high of 80 and a low of 55. And Sunday will be a strong thunderstorm late in the afternoon, or in the p.m., it says here, with a high of 82 and a low of 63. Monday will be humid and warmer with some sun, a high of 89 and a low of 66. And Tuesday will be hot with a thunderstorm possible, a high of 92 and a low of 62. The sun rose this morning at 6:38 a.m. and will set tonight at 8:19. Tomorrow, the sun will rise at 6:39 a.m. and set at 8:17 p.m. Next, here's the mini editorial. The fireworks ban was revamped as it didn't stop the celebration of freedom in the 40-plus years it was in effect. It did teach many people that laws can and are broken daily. Is this the behavior we want to teach our children and adolescents? Decide wisely. Let the young win this time. And this comes to us from Leo Hammond of Sioux City. Back to school night. This article is accompanied by a picture showing Adrian Omenzar, an incoming kindergarten student, holding on to his mother Margarita's purse while getting help during back-to-school night activities held Thursday at Sioux City's Les Hills Elementary School. Classes begin on Monday for students in the Sioux City Community School District. This comes to us from Caitlin Yamada of the Sioux City Journal from Sioux City. Students and their parents streamed into Sioux City schools on Thursday to meet their new teachers, unpack supplies, and tour their new classrooms. The annual back-to-school night event provides students, parents, and teachers an opportunity to prepare for quickly approaching the school year. At the Les Hills Computer Programming Elementary School, kids got to pick out a new book as they entered the building. The event helps break the ice for students, said physical education teacher Cynthia Tudehope. For the teachers, it helps them put a name to a face. The kids kind of know where they're going, and they've met their teachers, she said. Delavave Hoxie is going into the first grade. She said she is excited for school and greeted other students as they walked into the school. Her mom, Brianna Hoxie, said she is excited about the next year, but is worried about COVID-19. With her daughter and son, Coden Hoxie, unable to receive the vaccine, she worries about another infection in the family. Without a mask mandate for school, Brianna Hoxie said it is hard to get her daughter to wear a mask because everyone else is not wearing it, she said. Jonathan Leon is going into fourth grade and said his favorite part of the school are meeting new friends and learning more, especially math. His father, Saul Leon, hopes the students are safe and have a great school year. Jonathan said he likes wearing his mask, and his father added, "The students are well prepared for the school year. I think they're ready," Saul said. Students return to the classroom for in-person learning on August 23rd. Masks will not be required, but strongly recommended, according to the school's Return to Learn plan. Enhanced cleaning procedures in place and new this year, the school has acquired 16,000 rapid COVID-19 tests and will administer them with parent permission. If a child becomes sick at school, the caring room will still be in place this year. The room is equipped with supplies and equipment to determine if the child should be sent home according to the plan. If there are COVID-19 symptoms, the child's guardian will be contacted and a rapid COVID test will be conducted with parental permission. This year, the district hired 10 certified nurses' assistants to help with the workload. With the heightened cleaning procedures creating more work for the janitorial staff, the school board approved the use of up to $3 million in ESSER3 funding for hiring more teachers, janitorial staff, and more. The school hopes to hire up to 17 part-time custodians through 2014. And this article is accompanied with a couple of other photos showing the kids going to the orientation the night last night. Supervisors explore new AV equipment. This comes to us from Caitlin Yamada of the Sioux City Journal. The audio and visual system for the Woodbury Board of Supervisors may be updated to provide a better virtual experience. The update would improve audio quality, visuals for audience, camera angles, and the call-in method for viewers, said Director of Information Technology John Malloy. Malloy presented the board with a base bid as well as five alternates for consideration for the boardroom located in the basement of the county courthouse. The base bid from Conference Technologies, Inc. is $48,614.15 and includes the following. Replace the TV display with a larger screen, 8 microphone and speaker combinations, a document camera, also known as an Elmo, a voting system using keys on the microphone, a voting system software to log votes, 2 remote-controlled cameras, a replacement equipment rack, a new meeting software such as Zoom, and repositioning of existing speakers. The new system was compared to the Sioux City Council chambers. Malloy said the team reached out to multiple companies for bids, asking them to improve the audio and visuals. CTI also provided 5 alternates for the supervisors to consider. The 5 alternates are adding 7 display voting screens for the supervisors for $16,430.29, contractors installing acoustical panels on the ceiling in the center of the room for $15,865.96, building services install acoustical panels on the ceiling in the center of the room for $8,998.22, and 2 different options for additional CIT support for $1,906.76 and $2,585.16. County Building Services Director Kenny Schmitz said he would also like to replace the carpet in the room as part of the project, which would cost around $14,000. The board decided to have Chairman Rocky DeWitt work with Malloy to determine the best option. Reynolds vows to hold strong against mask mandates. This comes to us from Rob Beauchart of the Journal Des Moines Bureau from West Des Moines. Republican Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds fired back Thursday against threatened legal action by the Democratic Biden administration over the state's ban on mask mandates in schools, saying she plans to hold strong in ensuring parents have freedom to choose how to keep their children safe and may challenge any federal action that might impose modification or jeopardize funds designed to help schools deal with the pandemic. We are doing our job. He needs to do his job, Reynolds told reporters in response to Joe Biden's comments one day earlier, indicating he expects the U.S. Department of Education to use its broad powers to deter states, including Iowa, from barring universal masking in classrooms. The president directed U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona to explore whether a civil rights law gives the federal government authority to overturn state bans on mask mandates in schools. Unfortunately, you've seen throughout this pandemic, some politicians are trying to turn public safety measures, that is, children wearing masks in schools, into political disputes for their own political gain, Biden said Wednesday, according to the New York Times, which was the first to report on the directive. We are not going to sit by as governors try to block and intimidate educators protecting our children. Biden's directive prompted Cardona to put Iowa officials on notice that the new state law Reynolds signed in May appears to restrict the development of local health and safety policies and is at odds with the planning process as local school officials chart the return to the fall semester classes later this month. Cardona offered to partner with Iowa to further our shared goals of protecting students and educators, but noted federal officials will closely review and monitor whether Iowa is meeting all of its federal fiscal requirements. I think it's incredible he's coming after me when we led the country in getting our kids back to school, doing it safely and responsibly, Reynolds told reporters Thursday. We've done that basically from the beginning, where he just basically paid lip service to children all across this country while kowtowing to the teachers' union. And it is such a disservice and it is unconscionable what they are doing to those kids. And so we're going to do what we've done, and that is keep our kids in school. It went through the legislature. We had elected officials representing Iowans all across the state that voted on the bill, and I signed into law. We're doing what we need to do. The governor said state public health officials are monitoring COVID-19 infection, hospitalization, and vaccination rates daily, with plans to stand pat on Iowa's back-to-school strategies, but would make adjustments if need be. However, she told reporters she gets positive feedback every day at the Iowa State Fair from parents concerned about the social and emotional well-being of their children as they face challenges to their educational experience. They literally have tears in their eyes, tears when they come up to me and say, thank you for getting my kids back to school. Thank you for not masking them up, Reynolds said, challenging U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention officials to, quote, justify mask mandates. And the second thing that they, parents, are always saying to me is, hold strong. I want you to hold strong, and here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to hold strong. Reynolds did not rule out legal action if the U.S. Education Department decides to investigate Iowa and other states that have banned local school boards from requiring that students and teachers wear masks. If we've got to go to court, we will do it, the governor said. Reynolds took umbrage at federal directives for states and at Biden's stance that states should at least get out of the way of schools and educators taking steps to protect children in classrooms. I've been dealing with COVID for over a year, and he needs to do his job, Reynolds said. He needs to address and get Americans out of Afghanistan. He needs to close that southern border. We have a crisis at the border, a disaster in Afghanistan, and inflation is soaring. President Biden is failing on each of these issues, yet he is now launching an attack against governors like myself for trusting our people to decide what's best for them. The president's priorities are misplaced. I have had enough, and I know Iowans have too, she added. During a stop Thursday in northeast Iowa, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, a Red Oak Republican, stood by her Southwest Republican colleague, saying, Reynolds and governors of every state should be allowed to maintain their jurisdictions without federal interference. I think the states and local leaders are the ones who should be making those determinations. The federal government should not be imposing mandates, especially when it comes to a mask mandate. That should not be done by the federal government. I draw the line there. The federal government should as well, said Ernst. However, State House Democrats called Thursday on Reynolds to start listening to all parents and public health officials and take three actions before children head back to the classroom. State Representative Ross Wilburn, Democrat from Ames, who is chairman of the Iowa Democratic Party, Senate Democratic leader Zach Walls of Coralville, and House Democratic leader Jennifer Confrist of Windsor Heights, demanded the GOP governor accept $95 million in federal funding to increase testing in schools that she had rejected, return to daily instead of weekly reporting to the public of positive cases and hospitalizations, and allow every K through 12 school to follow the latest CDC guidelines, including masks and contact tracing. Earlier this month, a group of parents rallied outside the Iowa Capitol building in protest of the statewide masking ban. New data issued this week by the State Department of Public Health show COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations continue to climb in Iowa, with 16 more confirmed deaths added to the 6,226 total of Iowans who have died of coronavirus since the disease arrived here in March of 2020. James Q. Lynch of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau also contributed to this article. The FAQ for the day, the frequently asked question, is, do you know what is the most well-read story in each day's paper? And the journal staff replies, from an online standpoint, yes, we do. Thanks to a number of resources, we are able to track online traffic for our stories after they're put on SiouxCityJournal.com. We can tell how many people are looking at them at any given time and how long they spend with each one. When planning the print edition, this information is quite handy. It also helps us better react to our readers. And if you have a question for FAQ, send it to bmiller@siouxcityjournal.com or mail it to Bruce Miller, Sioux City Journal, 515 Pavonia Street, Sioux City, Iowa, 51101. Today's question is, for the online poll, have you finished your back-to-school shopping? Yesterday's poll question was, will you get a COVID vaccine booster shot when it becomes available to you? And of the 82 people voting, 72% said yes, they will get a COVID vaccine booster, and 28% said no. Today's speak out question is, what do you think about Facebook's New Horizons workrooms, a new way for office workers to connect using virtual reality? Youth Orchestra announces auditions from Sioux City. The Sioux City Symphony Youth Orchestra, SCSYO, a tuition-free youth orchestra training program, will be holding auditions for string players from 3:30 to 5:30 p.m. September 8th at Bishop Heelan Catholic High School, 1231 Grandview Boulevard. The Sioux City Symphony Orchestra, SCSO, has partnered for rehearsals, which will be taking place on Saturday mornings from September 11th through December 11th and January 22nd through April 23rd, 2022, culminating in performances that will be taking place on the stage of the historic Orpheum Theater. The symphony's flagship education initiative that is now in its pilot year, the youth orchestra will start with strings only. Music director Ryan Haskins said that this will engage students throughout the tri-state area. This is just the beginning, he said. In the not-so-distant future, the SCSO envisions a robust music institute with both educational and performance opportunities for young people, securing its place among the region's most important cultural landmarks. For more information on the Sioux City Symphony Youth Orchestra, auditions and rehearsals, contact SCSYO Administrator Dr. Bradley Medema at 712-277-2111 or at scyo@siouxcitysymphony.org. We turn now to the opinion page, and we have a letter from the editor called Happy 157th Sioux City Journal. This comes to us from Bruce Miller. Today, the Sioux City Journal begins its 157th year. That's more than 57,000 editions, giving readers the most comprehensive news about the people and events in Siouxland. When the paper started in 1864, the goal wasn't any different than it is today: cover the news and reflect the community. In that first four-page edition, writers updated readers on the Civil War, noted local business changes, and for entertainment, offered a poetry column. The ads took advantage of the times, including "Down with the Rebs and High Prices," and the editor offered a simple mission statement: "We come among you as any business to pursue our calling and to make a living." Over the ensuing 157 years, the journal has covered the region like a blanket, informing readers about everything from disasters to great victories and changes. It has provided a global look, too, helping residents make informed decisions about their lives. If you look back through those thousands of papers, you'll get a great picture of the past. Reporters were writing our history one day at a time. Now, we're just as committed as our predecessors. Even though there are other sources of information, none has the longevity or breadth of the journal or the tools. Thanks to new methods of delivery, we're able to give you a host of extras online: videos, photo galleries, background stories, and archives. That online edition, something our founders never dreamed of, is a great way to keep the story of Siouxland close at hand. Even better, it makes a great letter from home, informing college students about their high school teams, relatives about friends achieving milestones, and former residents about the community that helped shape their lives. To mark our 157 years, we're offering a special on the online edition: $19.99 for the first 6 months of unlimited digital access, and the e-edition. The rate runs through the month and ensures you're on top of the news wherever you go. That's a little more than $3 a month, or just pennies a day. To access the offer, go to siouxcityjournal.com/subscribe now. It's a great way to spread the news and help us celebrate 157 years. And again, that comes to us from the editor, Bruce Miller. Another editorial comes to us on Friday from Other Voices. This particular editorial comes to us from the Cedar Rapids Gazette. "Iowans left in dark without timely COVID data." Again, this is from the Cedar Rapids Gazette. According to data released by the Iowa Department of Public Health late Wednesday, Iowa recorded 4,872 new COVID-19 cases since August 4th. Hospitalizations jumped from 214 a week ago to 355, and 103 patients are in ICUs, up from 61 last week. The number of total pandemic deaths recorded in Iowa has now surpassed 6,200. These are numbers that are going in the wrong direction. The more contagious Delta variant of the virus is spreading in our communities. Vaccination is the best defense against serious illness, and yet the health department also reports that that it anticipates throwing away more than 200,000 vaccine doses set to expire. Although nearly 60% of eligible Iowans are fully vaccinated, vaccinations have lagged far below that number in many counties, particularly in rural areas. Early high demand for vaccine has stalled. Amid these troubling developments, Governor Kim Reynolds and her administration seem to be operating in an alternate reality, one where she has led us through a pandemic that has largely ended. But clearly, as the numbers indicate, the pandemic is not over. The governor has admirably urged Iowans to get vaccinated, but also has supported measures intended to appease those who discount the pandemic's severity and refuse to be vaccinated or wear masks. The mixed message likely has contributed to low vaccination rates in parts of the state. The governor often says she trusts Iowans to do the right thing. The right thing for Reynolds to do now is to begin a far more aggressive effort to convince Iowans to get vaccinated. Iowans also need more information to help them do the right thing. The IDPH has halted daily COVID data updates and now only releases information on case counts, hospitalizations, and deaths weekly on Wednesdays. This week, the state's COVID data website was updated at 11:45 p.m. With the Delta variant spreading, Iowans need timely public health information. Although Iowa has not seen the explosive outbreaks experienced in states such as Missouri, Arkansas, and Florida, the ingredients for an outbreak here clearly exist. Iowa kids will be starting school in a couple of weeks with districts prohibited from mandating masks or other mitigation efforts. Children 11 and under are not eligible to be vaccinated. With so much at stake, we have a right to know how the pandemic is affecting Iowans on a daily basis. Switching to weekly reports may fulfill the governor's wish to keep the virus out of daily headlines as she preps for re-election, but it leaves Iowans in the dark. And again, this came to us from the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Iowa teen sentenced to prison. This comes to us from Nick Heitrick of the Sioux City Journal. From Iowa, an Iowa teen was sentenced Thursday to 50 years in prison for the shooting death of another teen in a Mapleton, Iowa garage. District Judge Dwayne Hoffmeyer waived any mandatory minimum sentence that J. Lee Newbaum must serve before he's eligible for parole, according to court documents. Newbaum must also pay $150,000 to the estate of Joseph Hopkins. A Monona County District Court jury in May found Newbaum, 18, guilty of second-degree murder for the January 31, 2020 shooting death of 16-year-old Hopkins. Typically, a defendant found guilty of second-degree murder would face a mandatory minimum of 35 years in prison on the 50-year sentence. But Newbaum was 17 at the time of the shooting, and Iowa law says that if a person was under the age of 18 at the time of the offense, other than a Class A felony was committed, a judge may suspend all or part of the prison sentence, including any mandatory minimum sentence. Newbaum had been charged with first-degree murder, which is a Class A felony, but the jury found him guilty of the lesser charge. Hopkins of Mapleton was shot once in the forehead with a 12-gauge shotgun while he, Newbaum, and two other teenage boys were working on a demolition derby car in a garage at the home of Newbaum's grandmother, with whom he was living at the time. Prosecutors said Newbaum shot Hopkins after becoming angry with him because he would not stop playing with an unloaded 20-gauge shotgun. The defense said the shooting was an accident. Newbaum still faces prosecution in Monona County for 10 counts of third-degree sexual abuse for the alleged rape of 6 teenage girls and forced sexual contact with a seventh in 2019 and 2020. He has pleaded not guilty to all charges and is scheduled to stand trial in December. And Journal staff writer Dolly Butts contributed to this story. It's half past the hour, and it's time to turn to the obituaries. The first one comes to us from Sioux City. Richard Bruce Q, 66, of Sioux City, died Wednesday, August 17th at a Sioux City hospital. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday at Fouts Funeral Home in Dunlap, Iowa. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Friday at the funeral home. Richard lived in various locations. He moved to Sioux City and worked at Menards. He retired from Menards in 2017. Richard enjoyed watching TV, reading Western books, and collecting model cars. In Richard's younger years, he helped take care of Pleasant Hill Cemetery with his folks and siblings. From Sioux City, Donna Ray Martinson, that's D-O-N-A, I'm not sure if it's Donna or Donna. Donna Ray Martinson, 51, of Sioux City, passed away Tuesday, August 17th in Sioux City following a six-month-long battle with cancer. Services will be 4 p.m. Saturday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel with the Reverend Douglas Glass officiating. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to service time. Online condolences can be expressed at www.meyerbroschapels.com. Donna was born July 4th, 1970, in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, the daughter of Raymond and Marlos Martinson. In 1979, she moved to Spring, Texas, and later attended and graduated from Oak Ridge High School in Conroe, Texas, in 1988. In 1990, she moved to Sioux City, where she resided until her passing. Donna worked at Walmart on Singing Hills Boulevard. From Sioux City, Miriam Elaine Underwood. Miriam Elaine Underwood, 94, of Sioux City, passed away peacefully on Sunday, August 15th at Countryside Care Center. Graveside services will be held at a later date. Miriam was born April 15th, 1924, in Rock Township, Woodbury County, Iowa. She was the fourth child of Bert and Elise Henderson Effler. She attended several rural schools and graduated from Cushing High School. She was a helper at Sunrise Manor. She was a kitchen helper at Sunrise Manor for many years before retiring. From Sioux City, Lawrence G. Deming. Lawrence G. Deming, 67, died Monday, August 16th. Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel is in charge of arrangements. From Paulina, Iowa, Burdette R. Ewalt, 91, died Tuesday, August 17th. Services will be August 21st, 10:30 a.m. at Zion Lutheran Church in Paulina. Burial will be in Prairie View Cemetery at Paulina. Visitation will be August 20th, 5 to 6 p.m., Eldridge Family Funeral Home of Paulina. From Sioux City, Leila Veronica Lease, and that's L-E-I-L-A is her first name, and her last name is L-E-I-S. Leila Veronica Lease, 76, of Sioux City, passed away on Saturday, August 14th at a Sioux City nursing facility. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 21st, at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel with Reverend Andrew Gallus officiating. Visitation with the family present will begin 9:30 a.m. Saturday at the funeral home. Burial will follow at St. Michael's Catholic Cemetery in rural South Sioux City, Nebraska. Online condolences may be offered at www.meyerbroschapels.com. Veronica was born on November 18, 1944, in Sioux City to Frank J. and Coletta Weber Lease. She grew up on a farm between Waterbury and Allen, Nebraska. She attended and graduated from Ponca High School. Veronica worked and retired from Hobart as an office manager. And from Cherokee, Iowa, Virginia E. Phipps. Virginia E. Phipps, 91 of Cherokee, passed away on Saturday, August 14th at Carriage Hills in Cherokee. Services will be 11 a.m. Friday at Greenwood Schubert Funeral Home in Cherokee. The Reverend Tim Hogan will officiate. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery at Cherokee. Public visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday with the family present during that time at the funeral home. Online condolences may be sent to the family at www.greenwoodfuneral.com. Denny was born to Dr. James and Inez Easton Wise. She had always proudly called Cherokee her home. She graduated from Wilson High School in 1948. She attended college at St. Mary's of Notre Dame and transferred to the University of Iowa as a sophomore and graduated there with honors. While attending the University of Iowa, she was a member of the Scottish Highlanders, an all-girl bagpipe band that performed in France, England, and Scotland, as well as at all Hawkeye home football games. She was united in marriage to Nathan Phipps in 1953. She established a travel agency in Cherokee in 1965. This agency, later known as Nomad Travel Agency, had at one time offices in Holstein, Ida Grove, Sac City, and Storm Lake. The business in Cherokee and Storm Lake has continued under the management of her two daughters, Jenny Bright and Jean Patterson. While in the travel business, she organized and led tours to Europe, Hawaii, and the South Pacific. She escorted groups on cruises to the Panama Canal and Alaska. She also set up many bus tours throughout the Midwest, including many groups traveling to Hawkeye football games, home and away. In addition to being a very busy travel counselor and raising her children, she and her late husband, Big Nate, traveled the world. She was an officer of the Missouri Valley American Association of Travel Agents and served on the National Committee. She was appointed by Governor Robert Ray and served on the Iowa Energy Policy Council in the late 1970s. She was a devout Catholic and member of the Immaculate Conception Befrienders Group. She was a pilot and served as president of the Ladies Flying Club, the 99s. We turn now to a story captioned, Reynolds Accused of Violating Open Records Law. This comes to us from Iowa City. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' office is illegally delaying the release of public records related to its $26 million no-bid coronavirus testing contract, a pair of new lawsuits contend. Reynolds and her office's public records custodian, Attorney Michael Bowl, are the latest officials to be accused of violating open records laws by a Utah-based company investigating testing programs in several states. Paul Huntsman, chairman of the board of the Salt Lake Tribune newsletter, launched JITAI to seek public records related to Test Utah and similar programs in Nebraska, Iowa, and Tennessee. He is funding the requests and vowing to make public the findings, saying he wants to know how well the programs worked and whether public funds were used for private gain. Suzette Rasmussen, an attorney for JITAI who previously served as chief records officer for former Utah Governor Gary Herbert, filed two nearly identical lawsuits this week in Polk County against Reynolds and Bowl. They allege that Reynolds' office, for more than 5 months, has refused to timely and meaningfully respond to records requests related to the Test Iowa program. In two separate requests, Rasmussen in March asked the governor's office for correspondence related to Nomi Health, a Utah startup that was selected to run the program. The lawsuit says Bowl requested on July 20th that she provide particular search terms to look for records electronically, and Rasmussen responded the same day. Governor Reynolds and Bohl have knowingly refused to make the records available for Rasmussen for examination and copying, the petition state. The lawsuits ask a judge to order the pair to comply with the open records law, enjoin them from future violations for 1 year, assess damages, and award attorney's fees. The lawsuits also ask the court to order Reynolds and Bohl's removal from office if they are found to have engaged in a prior open records law violation for which damages are assessed. Iowa law says courts shall issue an order removing a person from office for a second such violation, but it's unclear whether that would apply to Reynolds. The Iowa Constitution gives lawmakers, not the courts, the power to impeach and remove the governor for misconduct. The governor's spokesman had no immediate comment. Rasmussen has filed other lawsuits seeking records from Utah, Governor Spencer Cox's office, Nebraska state epidemiologist, and the Iowa Department of Public Health. Rasmussen said Thursday that she and her clients are investigating how the testing contracts were signed, the validity of the testing, and the unprecedented use of political connections and political power in pushing these projects forward. Reynolds has said that she decided to copy Utah's drive-through testing program after receiving a tip from Iowa-born actor Ashton Kutcher, who was friends with a software executive working on it. Iowa signed an emergency $26 million contract with Nomi Health in April 2020 to obtain 540,000 coronavirus tests, which were produced by Utah-based Co-Diagnostics. Utah tech firms Domo and Qualtrics worked on parts of the program, which has since changed to an at-home testing and currently faces a backlog for kits. Nomi Health has been paid more than $35 million in all, according to Iowa's online checkbook. The lawsuits against Reynolds comes as the governor's office has faced increasing criticism for tightly controlling information during the pandemic and refusing to acknowledge or fulfill many open records requests. Randy Evans, director of the Iowa Freedom and Information Council, said recently, the state's compliance with the law is the worst he has seen in 50 years as an Iowa journalist. The case Rasmussen filed last month against Iowa's health department and records custodian Sarah Ekstrand seek correspondence between Department Director Kelly Garcia and officials in Utah, Nebraska, and Tennessee related to the testing programs. Ekstrand told Rasmussen in April that she anticipated having the requested fulfilled in 5 days, but no records had been released by late July, according to the lawsuit. The health department's former longtime spokeswoman Polly Carver Kim has filed a wrongful termination lawsuit alleging that the governor's office pushed her out for releasing public information and data requested by news outlets. State lawyers representing the governor and her spokesman have argued that case in the open records law is not a well-recognized public policy and therefore gives no legal protections to at-will employees who fulfill requests. Rural bankers worried about drought. This comes to us from Omaha. The economy continues to grow in rural parts of 10 plains and western states, according to a new monthly survey of bankers in the region, but some bankers in the region are worried that worsening drought could threaten their operations. The overall Rural Main Street Economic Index dropped slightly in August to 65.3 from July's 65.6. Any score above 50 suggests a growing economy, while a score below 50 suggests a shrinking economy. The survey showed nearly 16% of bankers believe that continuing drought conditions are the greatest threat to their banking operations over the next year. More than 40% of bank CEOs see low farm loan demand due to strong farm finances, according to the report, as their bank's greatest challenge over the next year. Bankers were less optimistic about the economy over the next 6 months than the previous month, with August's confidence index dropping to 59.7 from July's 65.6. Rising COVID-19 infections, the turmoil in Afghanistan, and negative views of current infrastructure bills before Congress damaged the economic outlook of bank CEOs, said Creighton University economist Ernie Goss, who oversees the survey. Only 9.4% of bankers support the passage of the $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill currently winding through Congress. Bankers from Colorado, Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming were surveyed. We have time now for a story from the sports page. Faith and family-driven, Mosman preps for second season with Crusaders. This comes to us from Zach James of the Sioux City Journal from Sioux City. The Bishop Heelan High School football team wants to play with a fighting mentality during the 2021 season. Heelan is in its second season under coach Chad Mosman and hopes that they can play with more focus, more confidence, and with a bit more faith. The Crusaders won just one game last season, one of those rare occasions for the team. A key part of that is that the Crusaders failed to finish out some games this year. They simply ran out of gas. Take the season opener against East, for example. Heelan kept up with the Black Raiders in the first game of the season, but the Black Raiders won that game in double overtime thanks to a key pass from Luke Longval to Devare Whitaker. That game set the tone for a team that tried to find their way, but when the chips were stacked against the Crusaders, they couldn't overcome those obstacles. The Crusaders senior Caleb LaFleur said he'd like to see the team finish stronger. "This year's big thing is to just swarm the football," LaFleur said. "We have to get 11 guys at the football every play. Faith is a big thing this year because there wasn't much of that last year. You've got to have faith in your teammates." To build that faith, the Crusaders spent most of the summer together, whether it was through team activities or on their own. The team finished the season with a big night earlier this month at Memorial Field. There were some moments where Mosman challenged the team, but of course there were just times when the players were just high school kids full of laughter. "There wasn't much of any chemistry or faith last season. Sure, there were guys who knew and liked each other, but the Crusaders also had players who had transferred in, like running back Devion West from West High School and Nathan Favors, who came from Dakota Valley. We'd lose momentum and then it would just crumble," LaFleur said. "It was just a back-and-forth, tug-of-war thing during the entire year. There were people who were in it for themselves. This year, we're making sure everybody's family, like all in this together." Mosman agreed that both sides of the football need to get tougher. "We need to have more of a blue-collar mentality," Mosman said. "Our offense and defense is going to reflect that. Our defensive players are judged by where you're at, according to where the ball's at when the play is done. So, if you're the guy that's never on the football, you're not very good on defense. We just want to get after it." On offense, the Crusaders' quarterback will be senior Caleb Gengler. Gengler is a 5'10", 170-pound thrower who takes over for Nathan Favors, who transferred in from Dakota Valley. Gengler took some snaps under center last season. He was 8-for-17 for 78 yards. He threw neither a touchdown nor an interception. Mosman expects his quarterback to be as good as he has been when it comes to play action. The Crusaders won't ask him to do anything that he isn't comfortable with. Caleb is a great play-action passer, and so we're going to work that off the run game, Mosman said. We're just going to suit things that fit him. He's a tough kid. He's more physical. And so we're going to utilize him with his abilities. And so our offense will be centered around what he can do. And he can block and throw and do it all. So we'll ask him to do all those things. Gengler wants to get the Crusaders back to the success they've known. I just need to be a big leader for the team this year, Gengler said. I mean, we lost a lot last year, but just build everyone back up and get Heelan back on track, on the track it's supposed to be on. The Crusaders found some good fortune at running back last season as Devion West joined the team. West took the load for the Crusaders, taking the ball 134 times for 537 yards. He scored the ball 7 times and he averaged 4.0 YPG. West is expected to have that same type of workload in 2021. The thing is, we're pretty deep at running back, so we're pretty fortunate there. Devion is a really good player, and I think ultimately he's going to have to be the main ball carrier for us, Mosman said. Another story from the sports page is headlined, Cardinals Continue to Grow. This comes to us from Zach James of the Sioux City Journal from South Sioux City. Chris Stein knows that his South Sioux City High School football team is still a young bunch of student athletes. That doesn't mean the expectations from the Cardinals' third-year head coach are limited. The Cardinals have had 2 losing seasons in the first 2 seasons under Stein, going 2-7 in 2019, and then seeing just a 1-game win season in a shortened 2020. The key word for Stein in 2021 is growth. With program age, we're still young, building 3 years into this program, Stein said. We are making strides. I think every year we have improved, and we want to see that continue this year. While he would like to see more than 1 win this season, wins will likely come in different forms. This brings us to the end of reading the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, August 20th, 2021. If you have any questions or comments for Iris, please call 1-877-404-4747. Thank you for listening to your Sioux City Journal. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. The Kingdom of Egypt prospered for 3,000 years in the desert. Its success depended on strong leadership, written language, mathematics and engineering, but most importantly, on the flooding of the Nile, which happened each June through September. Farmers developed an irrigation system that trapped floodwaters in their fields using dams. They let the water recharge the soil for a few months while the organics settled out, providing nutrients to the earth. They then release the water to the receding river and plant their crops. In this way, year after year, the fields could produce enough food to sustain a large population living in the desert. The floods were the direct result of African monsoons, which fell on the highlands of Ethiopia, the headwaters of the Nile. If the rain didn't fall, the Nile wouldn't flood. And there were some years that it didn't. Volcanic activity in the region filled the atmosphere with ash and gas, reflecting the sun's heat, producing evaporation, and therefore rainfall. Geologic and historical records now allow us to closely correlate volcanic eruptions with reduced Nile flooding, reduced crop production, reduced tax revenue for the state, and higher incidence of famine and revolt from the populace. Especially high volcanic activity in the last 300 years of the Egyptian kingdom contributed to its eventual fall to the Romans. Yet another example of how connected human civilization has been and continues to be to freshwater supply, weather patterns, and the geology of Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, keeping you connected on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.